Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
Well, one of the things that's on the table for us to discuss is the Ocean Declaration. You know, we started the Ocean Declaration preparation at the Ocean Ministers' Meeting in Cyprus.
The Commonwealth Heads of Government, or CHOGUM, schedules to meet in Apia, Samoa later this month.
The main motivation from our side was to decrease tension between Ethiopia and Somalia. Since Ethiopia was looking for an access to the sea, we told the Ethiopian government that we are ready to share one of our ports in the northern part of the country.
Djibouti's foreign minister says the country's offer to Ethiopia to gain access to the sea remains on the table.
And I always believe that the truth about Africa is told by the youth. Why? Because they are not conditioned to tell you what you want to hear. And if you really want to be able to make policy, if you really want to be able to invest in Africa, if you really want to understand the continent, you have to understand what these people think and believe.
And a survey shows Africa's youth demand action in addressing major challenges, including foreign support to African leaders in their fight to shape the future of the planet. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, or CHOGUM, is scheduled to be held in Apia, Samoa from October 21st to 26. It will bring together delegations from 56 nations, including Africa, the Caribbean, Europe, Asia, America, and the Pacific. Officials of the Commonwealth Secretariat say the meeting aims to reinforce multilateral cooperation, explore new opportunities, and try to solve challenges facing future generations. It comes after the foreign ministers of the Commonwealth agreed to an agenda that focuses on key agreements that will be reached at CHOGUM by world leaders. The agenda will focus on climate finance and climate justice, reparations, and the upcoming COP29 negotiations, among other things. Patricia Scotland is the Secretary General of the Commonwealth. The coming CHOGUM will be her last in the position. I reached her via video link to talk about the coming meeting in Samoa.
It really was focusing on the central themes that are important to all of us. And one of the main ones is, of course, climate change. And you will have seen, whilst we were in New York, what was happening in Florida, on the coast, and indeed what had already happened in the Caribbean. And so there was a lot of conversation about that. There was a lot of conversation about the money. You know that we've been banging the drum to say that the money promised for climate change needs actually to be delivered, and it still hasn't been delivered. We were also talking about the IFIs, because the debt to GDP ratio in many of our countries is just not sustainable. The debt has been incurred by trying to deal with climatic disasters, where countries have invested huge amounts in infrastructure, in human capital, in creating a safer, better environment, only to find that the hurricane destroys all that investment.
You also talked about the pledges that have yet to be fulfilled. What is the drawback? Because I understand the Commonwealth and some of the member states have been engaging some of these countries who made the pledges.
Well, this is the question that we ourselves are asking, because when the first promise was made in 2009, so we're not talking about yesterday, we're talking now about 15 years ago. This was said to be an ambitious pledge, but we know that we need trillions to fix this hole. So it wasn't ambitious enough then, and it needs to be much more ambitious now. We believe that every country who pledged must pay. Some have paid, some have not. And we need to drive this argument harder and firmer, because the financial peril in which so many of our countries are now cannot be addressed by them alone, and they didn't cause it on their own. Most of our countries made little or no contribution to the situation in which they now in. That, so it's not, it's unfair.
Chogum is coming up to be held in the Pacific Small Island Developing State, or SIDS, Samoa. What agreement do you anticipate world leaders to make during this meeting?
Well, one of the things that's on the table for us to discuss is the Ocean Declaration. You know, we started the Ocean Declaration preparation at the Ocean Ministers meeting in Cyprus, and we are pushing hard on that. 49 of the 56 countries have coastlines, and it is going to be incredibly important for our small states. One of the things we're saying is that once a jurisdictional boundary is fixed in the ocean, then sea level rise should not affect that boundary. And the reason we say that is a number of our members are right now in peril of not just drowning in debt, but as a result of the sea level rise, losing their whole state. So it's an incredibly important thing for us, and we will be using that as a platform to get an agreement that we can then take to COP29.
But Secretary General, you have repeatedly pushed for climate justice and climate finance.
Yes.
But some people are saying that although they agree with you, it appears to be unrealistic and unachievable. What are your thoughts briefly?
Well, the thing is, you know, Peter, that I always target specific things which are practical and deliverable. So if you look at when we started the Climate Finance Access Hub, people said, oh, it'll never work. Oh, you'll never get any money. We have. And so everything we've done is very practical and very focused.
Patricia Scotland is the Secretary General of the Commonwealth. She spoke with me from London. In New York, world leaders adopted a pact for the future that includes a digital compact and a declaration regarding future generations. Officials say it is the culmination of an inclusive years-long process to adapt international cooperation to the realities of today and the challenges of tomorrow. The pact, they added, covers several themes, including peace and security, sustainable development, climate change, digital cooperation, human rights, gender, youth, and the transformation of global governance. For more on the significance of the pact, the next steps following its signing, and the importance of youth involvement in decision-making, I reach George Hamting via Microsoft Teams. He is the Executive Director for Global Policy and Multilateral Initiatives at the UN Foundation.
The development is an interesting thing. This goes right back to before COVID, if you can remember that far back, although sitting here on Teams makes me very familiar with it. But before COVID, it was the 75th anniversary of the UN, and the UN decided to try and shape up an agenda to move the United Nations forward. As the Secretary General himself has said, a system designed by our grandparents probably isn't up to the needs of our grandchildren. And in fact, now it's a system designed by our great-grandparents. And then in that intervening period, we had COVID, we had the invasion of Ukraine, and we've now obviously got conflict elsewhere in terms of Gaza and Sudan. But particularly the COVID crisis and what happened in Ukraine showed just how interconnected our world is and how difficult it is to deal with some of those interconnected problems. Something like Ukraine wasn't just a crisis in terms of the war, it became a crisis in terms of financing, in terms of global supply chain, in terms of energy, beyond the humanitarian and the conflict itself. And in the same way, COVID itself showed how interconnected the world is and how we need more interconnected solutions ourselves to deal with the problems we now face.
So, George, what do you think are the next steps following the signing of this pact?
The pact itself picks up around about 58 different actions, and these stem from anything around space governance to an incredible turbocharging, I think, of international financial reform, which is of particular relevance to the developing world, given the $4 trillion needed to finance the Sustainable Development Goals, let alone climate financing around both mitigation and adaptation. So, across those 58 actions, there are all sorts of different follow-ups. So, for example, on AI and the Global Digital Compact, a new governance mechanism, but also a new scientific body is going to be put into place to look at some of those particularly complicated issues. Other things like Security Council reform, where in fact the PAC probably made the most ambitious statement on reform, particularly opening up to Africa since the 1960s, need to be taken up in other forums, in the General Assembly, again, in the Security Council itself. Other aspects will go into things like the race for the next Secretary General, where the pact itself made a call for greater recognition of gender, a female Secretary General when we come to that, and selecting a Secretary General in 2026. So all across the board, you've got probably one of the most expansive series of multilateral actions in a couple of generations, really, since around 2005 and the World Summit then.
What do you think is the importance of youth involvement in decision making regarding this pact?
One of the most fascinating aspects of what both the pact and the something called the Declaration on Future Generations picked up is this idea that we've seen generate more and more enthusiasm over the last couple of decades, which is the role not just for young people in how we govern ourselves, but the role of future generations, those not yet born, and how we consider them in our own decision making. And this declaration puts that at the very center of how we decide. In theory, it would appoint an envoy on future generations, but it's also going to the idea that in young countries, for example, in Africa or in Asia, 80% of young people will live in those continents, and we need to have those voices really taken into account in our decision making. And both the PAC and the Declaration for Future Generations starts to realign how we both make decisions internationally, but those voices that sit at the table and are taken into consideration when we're making those decisions.
Talking about the goal of the pact, what are your thoughts on achieving this very ambitious goal?
It's a great question. I think at a time where people look around the world and see such conflict, it can be difficult to see the grounds for progress. The former US diplomat, the now late Richard Holbrooke, once said of the UN failing, don't blame Madison Square Garden if the Knicks are losing. And I know you like sports, so I thought I'd chuck that in there. And I think that's part of it here. But on the other hand, we know that, you can't play at Madison Square Garden if you don't upgrade the floors since it was built in the 60s or put in new hoops, right? And so I think that's part of what the rationale is here. We need to continue to push to try and make the UN better so we can all perform better there as well. And finally, I think there is an opportunity for all of us around the world, to recognize that we have a part to play as well. It's not just about countries themselves, but it's about us pushing our leaders to step up in these moments. Because if we want a better future, we need to fight for it.
George Hampton is Executive Director for Global Policy and Multilateral Initiatives at the UN Foundation. He spoke with me via Microsoft Teams from New York. Djibouti's foreign minister says the country's offer to Ethiopia to gain access to the sea remains on the table. Mohamed Ali Yusuf says the administration in Djibouti City will continue to engage with both Ethiopia and Somalia to help ease political tensions between them. His remarks were made on the sidelines of the recently concluded UNGA meeting in New York. It comes after Ethiopia signed an agreement with Somalia's breakaway region Somaliland that grants Addis Ababa access to the Red Sea. The move angered Mogadishu, which accused Ethiopia of violating sovereignty. Here's part one of my interview with Djibouti's Foreign Minister Mohamed Ali Yusuf.
It is still on the table. The main motivation from our side was to decrease tension between Ethiopia and Somalia. Since Ethiopia was looking for an access to the sea, we told the Ethiopian government that we are ready to share one of our ports in the northern part of the country, even to give in the to concede the management of that port and see what kind of formula we can put together, like a joint venture, you know, company together, and then start, you know, giving Ethiopia the access to the sea that it has asked for. Of course, from our side, it's also a way of, boosting our trade with Ethiopia, creating new infrastructure, storage facilities. The corridor does exist to the north, but if Ethiopia can bring some of its traffic through Tajora port, that's how it's called, I'm sure that the region will take advantage of it. And Ethiopia will certainly create the conditions for a seamless transport of goods, and it will also certainly decrease or diminish the level of the cost of transportation. There are so many benefits for the two countries. So I think it's a win-win situation. The proposal is still on the table, and we are expecting a response soon from Ethiopia.
Are you engaging both Mogadishu and Addis Ababa regarding the option of the proposal still being on the table?
Of course, we, as the chair of IGAD, our main goal is to avoid any escalation and the tension to evolve to an open war between the two countries. So we are in close contact with Somalia. We are trying to help. Djibouti even organized the summit of IGAD to try to look into this issue in Entebbe, Kampala. So we are in trying to provide, the solutions so that, as I said, the tension do not evolve to a war, because in the region we don't need that. We have already the Sudanese crisis. We are, faced with the attacks of the Houthis on the vessels in the Strait of Bab el-Mandeb. So the whole Horn of Africa is in a situation where now is the time for our member countries of IGAD to turn the page of this period of tension. And now it's the time for all of us to look into the development programs. If you look at the regional economic communities on the continent, we are, in the back, of the list of regions that have, promoted their integration. We have to focus now in the integration between the countries. Our economies need that. So we're working for that. I think until Djibouti will be at the chairmanship of IGAD, we'll be really trying to boost that cooperation, that integration process between countries in the region. This is our duty.
Mohamed Ali Yusuf is Djibouti's foreign minister. He spoke with me from New York. Join us on Sunday for the conclusion of the conversation. The leader of Uganda's Opposition Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, is endorsing the party's secretary general as presidential candidate ahead of the 2026 presidential election. Patrick Oboy Amuriat says although other party members can compete to lead the party, his confidence remains in Nathan Nandala Mafabi, the FDC's secretary general. His endorsement came after the party's nationwide campaign to drum up support for the opposition party across the East African country. Patrick Oboy Amuriat tells me that the party remains strong in spite of recent events he says were aimed at undermining the strength of the FDC ahead of the next general election.
We have had a very, very busy 3 months going around the countryside, and this was basically a campaign that was intended to build confidence in the party, to register new members of the party, and also to let the population know that there are a lot of things that the ruling government, party in power, did promise them that are yet to be fulfilled. So this was like an eye-opener that we went around the country, and by the look of things, really, we pulled large numbers of people. Enthusiastic supporters did come out in droves to welcome us and to listen to our message.
I understand you are endorsing the General Secretary of the party, Nathan Bafabi, to be the presidential candidate ahead of the elections. Talk to me about this endorsement.
Nathan Nandala Mofabi is an extremely competent person. He is somebody who has served in parliament almost 25 years now and still going strong. He has connected both nationally and internationally. And he is an international figure, I would say, and somebody who has got a network of contacts. And so what I say to the public here is that he is extremely competent and an asset to the party, and I wouldn't have really a problem if he so wished to contest in the coming elections. However, this largely depends on him. If he warms up for it and, you know, is definitive on this and comes out quite clearly, then I don't think many people would have a problem him being the flag bearer. But be that as it may, it does not shut the door to a possible competition. As listeners may know, we are a democratic party, and our party encourages internal competition, internal democracy. And so anybody who thinks they are competent enough can offer themselves to compete, to become the flag bearer. And so really, it's still wide open, and we do not want to slam the doors on whoever may be interested in running to become the flag bearer of the FDC.
The FDC, according to reports, is sharply divided, and people are confused whether you are still the legitimate leader or not. Court cases have been filed back and forth. Even some members of your party, I understand, have defected, trying to form a new political party. Where does the party stand now?
Well, for us, really, the storm is over. And clearly, we have got a leadership that was elected on the 6th of October, 2023. And so we are almost 1 year into our new term as office bearers. For me and the Secretary General, this is our last term holding the same offices. And this goes for the Treasurer General as well. We do not deny the fact that we got colleagues of ours who are not satisfied with what is happening within the party. And, you know, there have been all sorts of attempts by those friends of ours, including our founding president, Colonel retired Dr. Kizza Besigye, and the mayor of Kampala, Elias Lukwago Salongo, to undermine my authority and the authority of those holding positions in the party. But by and large, we are the recognized leaders, and so all correspondences regarding the FDC are done by us. When they're internal, it is me who communicates. When the external, the Secretary General does communicate, and this, his signature is recognized everywhere, including recognized by our bankers. So no worries. I believe that we are on track, and I think we are not going to lose any sleep over what is happening with our colleagues. We wish them well. If they wish to form a new organization, it is within their right, it's within the Constitution of the Republic of Uganda for them to associate in whatever way they would like within the Constitution. And, you know, luckily for us, we have got an experience that we went through before.
Patrick Oboye-Amuriat is the leader of Uganda's Opposition Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. A youth survey across Africa shows that young people are demanding action in addressing major challenges, including foreign support to African leaders in their fight to shape the future of the planet. Conducted by the Itikowitz Family Foundation, the release of the findings coincided with the anger in New York. The findings show that China leads as the most influential foreign country in Africa with 76%, followed by the U.S. with 70%. About 64% of youth also want African leaders to play a more assertive role in global politics. For more on the findings, I sat down with Ivor Itikowitz in New York on the sidelines of the anger. He's an industrialist, philanthropist, and chairman of the Itikowitz Family Foundation.
So this is the fourth survey we've done. It's important because when we started this, everybody laughed at us. First of all, they said, well, why do we want to know what the youth of Africa think? This is not going to be valuable. And I always believed that the truth about Africa is told by the youth. Why? Because they are not conditioned to tell you what you want to hear. And if you really want to be able to make policy, if you really want to be able to invest in Africa, if you really want to understand the continent, you have to understand what these people think and believe. And because this is a generation that is not prepared to sit by quietly and let their leaders determine their future without their voice being heard.
In the survey, the youth, I understand, were also expressing concern about external influence on their leaders in Africa. They talked about the growing influence of China and, in some instance, the United States and subsequently Russia. Talk to me about the findings.
In the past, the United States owned a lot of the mind share of these people. And it's interesting because the U.S. is not present in Africa in terms of affecting the everyday life of Africans generally. But U.S. American culture, the American way of life, the American value system was what was aspirational to most Africans. But we're in the second version of the Cold War right now, and that is happening in Africa. We are in the middle of a battle for the hearts and the minds of the population of Africa. And everybody is talking about governments being captured by Russia and China and a political landscape being created which excludes the United States and excludes Europe. But that's not what's happening. There is an active campaign by Russia and China to capture the hearts and minds of the populations of Africa. Before COVID, our survey showed that the U.S. dominated cultural influences, aspirational influences. After COVID, the switch was 180 degrees in favor of China. And there was an interesting reason for that. In the absence of active collaboration, what was left? The roads the Chinese built, the stadiums the Chinese built, the telecommunication system the Chinese built, the healthcare system the Chinese built, and the West was completely absent.
So what do they want their leaders to do, according to the survey? What do they want their leaders to do in terms of these influences that seem to be growing?
So the picture is complex because this is one thing that's not in the hands of African leaders. In my opinion, and it's very much a personal opinion, it is totally unfair for the West to impose on Africa collaboration when there is no policy of investing and developing the continent. Promises are made all the time. Those promises are not kept. It's one thing to pledge investment money into Africa. It's another thing to deliver it. You know, we're transforming most African leaders today, and most populations in Africa don't want aid. We're no longer a continent that either values aid or needs aid. What we need is exactly what's built the rest of the world, and that's investment.
But what happens with the issue of democracy and rule of law? Because, you know, the youth said they want to have their say in how they are governed, and they also want to have their say on who leads them.
So this is fascinating, because the survey has shown us over years that in principle there is strong support for the concept of democracy, but there's also a very strong sense that democracy is failing Africa. Now, the style of democracy that we currently have in Africa is a Western style of democracy. Terms are short, there's pressure on leaders to move on fast, and this isn't working for the continent. The youth are saying it's time to start looking at an African style of democracy. Now, I don't know what that is, and they're not telling us yet.
Ivo Ichikowitz is the chairman of the Ichikowitz Family Foundation. He spoke with me from New York. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Veronica Nduva, the Secretary General of the East African Community, or EAC, says she is implementing measures to bolster regional cooperation among member states of the regional body. Nduva, who recently marked her first 100 days in office, also says she seeks to help implement the vision and objectives of the EAC. For more on her plans for the East Africa Community, I caught up with Nduva on the sidelines of the recently concluded United Nations General Assembly in New York.
I have in mind ensuring that we are moving the progress of the EAC from one level to another, looking at what are the heads of summit, because I want to tell you this, the heads of summit, who are the presidents of the 8 countries, are very committed, have a great vision for the integration process. So it is incumbent upon me to ensure that their vision is realized into tangible, measurable, implementable things and interventions that we can look back at. So, of course, you do know that under customs union and common market, which are our first basic principles, my vision is to hope that I can move the digital integration process a step further through maybe the digital payment systems, ensuring that we have less stays of application if possible, and also elimination of non-tariff barriers. On the matters of peace and security.
I was going to ask you about peace and security. Okay, on peace and security, what do you want to do?
Well, peace and security is the most, it's an onion peel, let me say that, for the region. Because we have, on one hand, good and cordial relations, but we do have instances of a little bit of strain on interpartner state relations. And then we also have the general outstanding issues that have been there for some time, including the issue of peace and stability in the Eastern DRC. I'm happy to say that within the first 1 month of my being in office, we were able to implement a directive from the summit, which was to bring together the foreign ministers and ministers of EAC within the region to just have a nice discussion on inter-partner state relations. And I've said it's an onion peel, which means that it's not something that will be achieved today. It's not something that is direct. It's something that has several stages. And the most important thing is just to keep the momentum, to ensure that conversations are happening and there's an open door policy and that we are collaborating, because there are very many actors in this space.
Is there real commitment from member states to ensure that your vision for ensuring peace and stability in the region is maintained?
I would say yes, because commitment is demonstrable. The fact that we have 8 partner states who have committed to integration, who have come up with a roadmap, who contribute their resources towards the integration process, towards the pillars of integration, peace and security being one among them, is enough demonstration of commitment. So yes, I would say that without absolute conflict of doubt, that the partners, the various nations, are committed to the dialogue. It is going to be steady. It is going to be over time. But I am very positive we are moving in the right direction.
What about those who have concerns that the integration, mm-hmm. although much touted, mm-hmm. appears to be too sluggish, mm-hmm. or the lack of movement? There mm-hmm. appear to be no catalyst to jumpstart the process mm-hmm. towards the real integration the leaders themselves have talked about, and the expectations of citizens within the East African corridor.
I would throw back the question to you and ask, what is really integration? The East African community boasts in the continent of Africa of the most integrated customs union. one-stop border post, free movement of goods and services across borders, movement of trackable goods in the tracking system. I can track a lorry from Burundi to Dar es Salaam. I can track a lorry from Rwanda to Mombasa, real-time tracking. We have interoperable systems, revenue systems. We have common external tariffs. We have harmonized our fiscal policies, and we continue to move. So what is more commitment to integration than that?
Veronica Nduva is the Secretary General of the East Africa Community, or EAC. She spoke with me from New York. In Namibia, civil society and media groups have launched an initiative to fact-check information to help voters to make informed decisions in the coming November 27 general election. It comes as Namibians go to the polls to elect a new president and National Assembly. Analysts say the elections are going to be competitive, adding that giving voters accurate information will be crucial in determining who leads the country. Frederico Links is the editor at Namibia Fact Check. He tells me that the group plans to verify claims by politicians and political parties and provide reliable, accurate, and non-partisan information to voters in the coming elections.
This initiative came about from, you know, discussions we've been having with some partners over the last few months around what happened in South Africa with the South African elections and some of the things that they did there. And the feeling was maybe we can, you know, replicate this somehow in Namibia. And we spoke to some people that were involved in a similar coalition in South Africa. And then Africa Check contacted us and said, would this be something we'd be interested in? Because that's what they were part of a coalition in South Africa in the run-up to those elections. And, you know, we jumped at the chance. And so they said they have some support from the Google News Initiative. They've had similar coalitions or assisted with similar coalitions in other countries, in Rwanda, in Senegal, and so forth.
How beneficial or important will this fact-checking take place to the prospective voters or voters during the polling?
Yeah, I mean, so we're already seeing a lot of mis- and disinformation. You know, we already have a credible information problem here in our Namibian information landscape in general. So the aim is really to try and make sure that credible, accurate information gets through to voters by, you know, providing fact-checking services, and also by distributing media information literacy content, you know, around voting, around what's supposed to happen on the polling days and so forth, through our partners. So making use of the platforms where we all, you know, primarily operate and use to disseminate information and try and get information across, accurate, credible, across to our audiences.
Will you also engage the Electoral Commission of Namibia in this work?
Yes, I mean, we've already engaged the ECN, and they've asked that we meet and, you know, and explain to them what it is. I'm just waiting for them actually to come back and give a date and a time so that we can have this meeting. I mean, we really would like the ECN to be part of this, at least, you know, sort of an associate coalition member, because a lot of the information, a lot of the misinformation out there online concerns the ECN, and we really feel that the ECN needs to be part of this in whatever way it would suit them.
The question that some are asking is, will this information be accessible to those in the villages where they don't necessarily have internet access?
Yeah, so that's why, you know, we very deliberately invited the community broadcasting, Namibia Community Broadcasters Network in, so that we can have the community broadcasters, because that's the media closest to people at grassroots level in the rural areas, and some of the far-flung areas. It's really just that community broadcaster, and then, of course, the state-owned national broadcaster. So we invited the, very deliberately invited the Community Broadcasting Network to be part of this. And they are part of this initiative. And hopefully, you know, how we've put it to them is, look, you can take, when we produce content, you can take it and you know, break it into broadcastable content or broadcast items and in a language that speaks to your audience. And you broadcast it, and so that's what we are really encouraging, for instance, our community broadcasting partners to do with content like that, so that we can reach people in the rural areas where the community broadcasters have reach. So that's you know, one of the ways that we would like to think we'd be able to do that.
Frederico Links is the editor at Namibia Fact Check. He spoke with me from the Namibian capital, Windhoek. Amid worries the Middle East is on the brink of a wider war, Friday's press briefing at the White House turned out to be anything but routine when President Joe Biden appeared at the podium to answer reporters' questions. VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman reports from Washington.
President Joe Biden, making his first appearance in the White House briefing room since he took office, told reporters Israel has every right to strike back against attacks from Iran and its proxies such as Hezbollah in Lebanon and the Houthis in Yemen. Biden said the Israelis are still contemplating how to respond to being targeted Tuesday by 180 ballistic missiles fired by Iran.
If I were in their shoes, I'd be thinking about other alternatives than striking oil fields.
Asked if Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is trying to influence the U.S. election in favor of Republican nominee Donald Trump by stalling any peace deal, the president replied he does not know, but that Netanyahu should remember no American leader has done as much for Israel as he has in the past 4 years. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
Right now it's time for music from my African collection. Fatima Tae, oh ma belle, oh ma belle. Rumba music. Ta façon d'aimer, c'est pas joli, c'est pas gentil, façon comme ça. Ta façon d'aimer doudoué, c'est pas joli, c'est pas gentil, vraiment fadi. Ta façon d'aimer chérie, jaloux, 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 t'es trop jalouse. Tu vois même devant les gens, tu perds la tête, c'est pas gentil, oh ma belle. Parfois même devant nos invités, tu perds la tête, c'est pas gentil, oh ma belle. Jaloux, 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 t'es trop jalouse. Tu vois même devant les gens, tu perds la tête, c'est pas gentil, oh ma belle. Parfois même devant nos invités, tu perds la tête, c'est pas gentil,
kota tusiki kipituli kale kanyota atukudani kama tutawakuta bahati ya Mungu tukalimbuka chapu chapu kazi nzuri tukafika tuko nao pamoja tunaruka.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Impuga and engineer the mighty Helen, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, you cannot tempt a goat with a cake. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.